Hello and welcome to another episode of Romaniacs, the podcast that metaphorically waves an EU flag at the last night of the proms. Every week we listen to the mood music of Brexit Britain and find more often than not that it's a sad trombone. I'm Dorian Linsky and this week we'll be discussing the parliamentary shenanigans behind the legislation formerly known as the Great Repeal Bill. Monday night, the EU withdrawal bill passed its second reading in the Commons with unanimous Tory support and the help of seven Labour backbenchers who defied the whip. Theresa May said it offered certainty and clarity, while Labour called it an affront to parliamentary democracy. But which is it? Let's find out. We'll also be weighing up the latest economic news and asking whether anything that annoys Nigel Farage can be a bad thing. And we'll be having an extended chat with this week's special guest. We'll meet him in a minute, but first let's say hello to the regulars. Peter Collins is a former business editor of The Economist and ex-BBC, and now he's a rogue Brexitologist. At the weekend, we went on the People's March for Europe together. That was a good day out, wasn't it?
It was. A splendid time was guaranteed for all, except apart from David Davis and Liam Fox and all that rabble, of course. The sky was blue, and I'm sure I saw some yellow stars in it, so somebody up there is sending us a message.
And he couldn't be with us on Saturday, but he's here when it counts. It's Ian Dunt, editor of politics.co.uk, and author of Brexit, What the Hell Happens Now? Hi, Ian. I hear you've been moonlighting on Guardian Politics Weekly. Have you burned through all your best material?
Wow, this is like, you've set a trap for me here. I see how that works.
Have you got anything left in the tank?
No, you know what? I can still find a little bit more indignation to take me through.
And you've just published a piece about soft Brexit that took 6 actual weeks.
You know, it might have even taken longer. That was the most hellish, unspeakable thing. You're talking to all these guys that sort of wrote EEA agreements and sat around, you know, at the top of the EFTA court, and they constantly talk in this incredibly bizarre way about conversations between courts and like the culture in a thing. And you really have to talk to an awful lot of them before you have any idea what the hell it is that they're properly talking about in any practical sense. So when I finally got this thing done and out there, it was just the greatest relief that I would never again, well, at least for not another couple of weeks, have to delve into any of this material.
And we're delighted to welcome Nick Cohen. He's a veteran columnist for The Observer and Spectator, author of books such as What's Left and You Can't Read This Book, and Scourge of Brexit Delusions.
Thanks for having me on. It's a great pleasure. And honour, I should say.
I'm delighted. We're honoured too. We'll be talking at length with Nick later. Before we get to the news, here's Peter with some important information.
Yes, don't forget that Romaniacs now has its own YouTube channel where you can find the complete show every week, plus the occasional fun-sized titbit. Go to YouTube and search for Romaniacs and please subscribe as well. Apple users, please subscribe via the iPhone Podcasts app or iTunes and do your bit by leaving us a nice review and star rating. Every single one helps us to reach more people. We currently have well over 100 five-star reviews, but we'd like to have more. For example, Sister Calf says, I'm so grateful this podcast exists, being the listening highlight of my week. I've learned many things, disagreed with some ideas, probably Ian's, and positions taken, and hooted or cheered out loud often. Thank you, Romaniacs team. Keep going, a candle in the dark. Well, we like Sister Calf. On our trusty website, you can find all sorts of links to Romaniacs, including on Spotify, Acast, iTunes, and Stitcher. I don't know what some of these are, but they're very important because they're ways to get the podcast. Anyway, go to romaniacs.com.
Brilliant. We're going to just keep adding some made-up ones.
I won't notice.
Right, bring me my bow of burning news. On Monday night, the EU withdrawal bill passed its second reading by 326 votes to 290. The bill overturns the 1972 European Communities Act, which took the UK into what was then the European Economic Community, and converts all existing EU laws into UK law to avoid any black holes on legislation on Brexit Day. Keir Starmer called it a naked power grab by the government, and Tom Brake, the Lib Dem Brexit spokesman, called it a dark day for the mother of parliaments.
So the point is that this power grab refers to the so-called Henry VIII powers. So the bill's perhaps most controversial aspect is it gives the government all these sweeping powers to make all sorts of changes to all sorts of laws using what are called statutory instruments, essentially ministries issuing changes to the law with pretty much minimal scrutiny by Parliament. They've become known as Henry VIII powers over the years, although so far the government's Brexit performance has been more like Ethelred the Unready. There was no great Tory rebellion, as you said, but quite a lot of Conservatives as well as opposition MPs said they're determined now to force through quite significant changes as the bill goes into committee stage. Because it's an important bill, the committee it goes through to have everything picked over is a committee of the whole House. So there'll be plenty of opportunity for amendments. Two, interestingly, two Conservatives Conservative ex-ministers, Dominic Grieve, who is, of course, a known Remainer, and John Penrose, who's a member of that pro-Brexit European research group, got together to propose an amendment that would create a joint committee of the Houses of Commons and Lords to go through all these statutory instruments and basically say, no, we're having a proper debate on this one, which seems to me to make a lot of sense.
So was this week's vote ever close, or was it inevitable?
You know, we've talked before, you know, when will we find a Tory spine, basically? But they don't seem to be out there. We do hear the talk, you know, you hear Subri talks very eloquently, Grieve talks very eloquently, out it comes. When it comes down to the votes, they do not perform. Now, and that's not just on the repeal vote. You could potentially say, look, we've got to get it through to the stage where we've got amendments, you know, so we'll get it through to committee stage, we'll chuck in the amendments. And that was clearly what they did. They started queuing up afterwards, chucking this stuff in. The clear idea is just to, you know, take it into an alleyway somewhere and just start slicing it up and seeing what you can do with it, as the Lords will continue, I imagine, more effectively than MPs. But last night, this is recorded on Wednesday again, last night was a separate but related initiative, which was really about stacking the odds in the Conservatives' government's favour, as if they had a majority in the standing, the selection committee, which will go to the standing committee, which all sounds very dry, but is essentially the mechanisms by which legislation is evaluated. And on that, again, there was no Tory rebellion. So at the you have to reach the point where you're like, well, they talk and they talk and they talk. The supposed Remainers in the Tory party, supposed soft Brexiters, supposed constitutionalists who are also concerned about these sudden executive power grabs. But when the moment comes for them to do something, I see absolutely nothing from the Tory benches whatsoever.
Can I make a point that isn't being made yet because, you know, we're still moving into this swamp? When it won't just be ministers on their own won't just be drawing up laws which have the force of acts of parliament. I mean, this is a bit more than the old Henry VIII powers. We saw they specifically say in the bill we can actually behave as if we are parliament, which is extraordinary. They will be lobbied. They'll be lobbied very, very hard, and rightly so. You know, if you're a farmer, if you're working in manufacturing, if you're working in finance or media, you've got all these regulations suddenly affecting you. Obviously, you want to lobby. But we're then going to have the wholly execrable situation, in my mind, where lobbyists will be influencing policy in secret, because these will be private meetings, obviously, whereas Parliament can't discuss them in public.
Yeah.
It's the kind of the taking back control for Parliament thing seems to have gone out the window.
It's almost like these people don't have the courage of their convictions in some way.
And what happened with the seven Labour rebels, which included John Mann, Dennis Skinner, our old friend Kate Hoey?
To be fair, most of them are the sort of tried and tested proper Brexiters. They're proper Eurosceptics. There's an awful lot of, you know, hanging back and not voting at all by the Caroline Flints of the world, who just feel that they can't explain to their constituents about freedom of movement and the single market. So that's one way of doing it. The other way was a sort of Dennis Skinner way. He sort of wrote an article saying, well, look, I've been doing this my whole life. You know, I've always been going into that lobby when it comes to the EU. And to be fair, he has actually been doing that his whole life. But that does not extend to the idea of him, you know, as this sort of tried and tested defender of the workers, suddenly going to the Tory party, you get to enact whatever anti-worker legislation you want without any debate in Parliament. So that seems to me either that he is so afraid of, you know, of his own supporters thinking that he's being insufficiently protective of Brexit, or that he has, you know, he's taken the pill and he has taken that mania of supporting the will of the people, and that this bill somehow does that. This bill has nothing to do with implementing Brexit. It is to do with how you implement Brexit. And the manner that they have chosen to do it is the manner that, by some coincidence, gives them the maximum degree of power imaginable.
To go back to what Ian was saying about the spineless of the Tory Remainers, the fact you've got all these red Tories like Dennis Skinner, oh, it's so nice to call him a red Tory, really is, means that you will need a bigger rebellion on the Conservative benches to overcome those Labour MPs who are pro-Brexit, like Skinner and Hoey, and those who are too scared of having an argument with their constituents, like Flint and the rest of them. In other words, it's not just, despite the effectively Tories are a minority government, you're still, it can't just be one or two Tory MPs rebelling to threaten them. It's going to have to be 20 plus out of four.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the result, so yesterday doesn't quite count because obviously you had a firmer line, but you'd have needed, I suppose, 11 Tory rebellions in order to get an over. And that's what
this
it came down to.
This is Tuesday night we're talking about.
Yeah, so this is Tuesday night on the committee vote, which is obviously slightly different because it's disconnected from Brexit. You know, I think you're quite right. We've got to be looking at sort of 20, 25 Tory rebels. I can't see the numbers for that at the moment. I just don't see where they'd come from. There seems to be such little evidence of spines out there.
And what amendment should we be rooting for?
The obvious one that Grieve and Penrose, which sounds like a brand of gentleman's luxury grooming product, need that as available at all branches of John Lewis. But that's a very good idea. That you know that a committee is empowered to say, sorry, we're going through all these statutory instruments. This one needs debate. That one's a minor technicality. You can have that one, but this one needs debate. And that's the obvious one, it seems to me.
There's always this danger of what do they often try to do with sort of protections on statutory instruments is to drive it towards delegated legislation committee, which, you know, among other facets, has the power by its mere name to send people to sleep and stop them from paying attention. But really, you know, it sounds like that adds a degree of scrutiny, but it doesn't. Because at the end, those delegated legislation committees, which, by the way, by virtue of the vote on Tuesday, the government will be able to stack with MPs on their side of the House.
Oh, quite.
Mm. Yeah. Even then, doesn't actually have a vote on the final terms. It only gets to evaluate the statutory instrument by whether it is rational in law, not by its effect, and it has no veto on it. So there's always this way where they always try to say, you know, Parliament will be in control of these measures. But when you actually look at what it involves in plain terms and get rid of all the obscure and arcane language, what you find is just utter toothlessness in the constitutional arrangements for how these things are evaluated. So they will relentlessly try to fob us off. And I predict an awful lot of this because really that bill reads like the opening bargaining statement from the government. They overshot as much as they could. Basically, sort of as Nick said, just give us all the powers, including with the insanely pernicious Clause 9, which not only gives the powers, but then says we can use the powers on this bill. So any safeguard they put in that bill, unless Clause 9 is taken out, is completely irrelevant because the powers can be used to wipe out the safeguards in the bill which proposed them in the first place. So they will now come up with all these solutions to say there'll be more, but I would advise to look very closely at the committees that they suggest and what they entail, because most of the time they're not worth the paper that they're written on.
And what about the intervention by the ever-popular Tony Blair and Lord Adonis suggesting that a possible compromise in which France and Germany offer Britain prospect of staying in the EU but with stricter immigration controls? So it's sort of, you know, it's basically going, look, this was a vote about immigration and freedom of movement, and if we can get concessions there, maybe we don't have to do all the other stuff.
I may have to ask the audience to retreat to a safe space before I say this, but Blair has a point. His argument has always been, and the argument of a lot of people who actually understand diplomacy, understand the world, unlike the government, which has virtually one reason our diplomats are in such a mess, is diplomats don't just operate on their own. They talk to ministers. The ministers say, it's okay, I know so-and-so, he's Prime Minister of Sweden, or I know Macron of France, so we're friends, we can cut a deal. None of that. There are no contacts. And Blair, the point has always been made is, after the referendum, what May ought to have done is, first of all, just gone to the EU and said, right, we've had this, immigration is a massive issue, for good reason, can I say. You know, we've had one of the biggest immigration movement of people into Britain in our history. What can you give us? You know, you thought Cameron was bluffing or he was going to win anyway. It didn't matter. What can you give us? I think it might be too late now. But, I mean, of the many, many diplomatic, what's this horrible American word? We've got now missteps. You heard missteps. Yeah. It's such a genteel word. Oh, the politician missteps if he's a dainty lady falling off her heels. Of the many total, utter cock-ups we've had since the referendum, that has been one of the biggest. It's this failure to just say, throw it back to the EU and say, look, we don't want to leave. People still want the single market. But you've got to give on this. Can you help? And then if they say no, then say, OK, we'll move on from there. It's not such a bad idea from Blair. Okay, listeners, you can leave your safe space now. The Blair segment is over.
So, I mean, I struggle with him, I mean, much more than you, and I obviously struggle much more with the immigration stuff. I don't want to hear any of that stuff. I have to say, strategically, I think it's really useful that there is a wing of Remain that is talking in the terms that Blair is talking. You could almost define the effectiveness of it by how much I don't like fucking hearing it. Because as soon as it comes out, you're like, oh, this is just dreadful old nativist nonsense. And it's describing a problem which I do not think exists in this country. And yet, that conversation has to be taking place on some wing of the movement. And I think in another way...
Well, he's changed because... When was it? It was January. Before he re-emerged on the public scene because of all of this, he called lots of people in, including me, for a chat. And I said, surely the Blairite thing to do at the moment is to compromise on freedom of movement. And he went, no, Nick, no, we've got to have freedom of movement. So he's moved, you know, he's moved from your position, if you like, off saying, you know, this is just ridiculous. You know, people don't understand what problems are, and half these problems are inventions and fantasies, to saying, well, actually, I think if you're going to get any kind of, if you're going to save something from this wreckage, you've got to take this on.
You've got to have an offer. So I see that part. This is, with the paper was actually quite interesting and subtle and had some quite interesting ideas in it, more, I think, than the press really gave it, than the coverage acknowledged. Most of it is probably possible within the EU. Some of it I don't think is. So the core thing, the first thing, is that you can just say that people need to register within 3 months. And if you don't have a job offer or the means to sustain yourself after 6, you've got to go. Now, European countries do this all over the place. Germany does it, Denmark does it, Norway does it in EFTA. This is something that can be done. The other offers that he was talking about, which is sort of, you know, allowing discrimination on the basis of sort of university provision or jobs, that's not quite so clear whether that can be done. And actually, I mean, Switzerland have tried and they've got this watered down sort of version. But even that alone shows that a conversation about that can take place within the EU. So again, possible, maybe possible. It does make me uncomfortable, but I do see that there is a strategic advantage to having someone making that case.
Do you and Peter think that the well has been so poisoned now that conversations that could have happened
with the EU,
about a year ago?
It seems to me yes is the short answer. But I guess let's imagine a miracle that Theresa May decides to go. I don't know, it won't be Kenneth Clark, unfortunately, in her place. But let's suppose it's somebody who decides, the new prime minister, says, right, we're going to stop being, you know, calling names across the water at the Europeans. Let's try to be constructive in the talks. And then maybe the other side thinks, actually, we've got a change here. That's the only things I can think of that would unpoison the well right now.
There are articles in the EEA agreement. I think it's, oh God, fuck my life. I think it's 112 to 113. Which
that on Sky. Yeah.
The Guardian Politics Weekly would accept that either. It's Ian Uncut.
So I think it is 112 and 113. But correct me if I'm wrong, which basically allow you to sort of have some sort of emergency break on any aspect of the agreement. Now, Cameron tried to bring this stuff up in his negotiations, and they were like, well, you don't need it because you can't demonstrate that there's particular strain on your public services. You can't demonstrate there's particular strain on your economy, for the simple fact that there wasn't. Now, the question then becomes, if, assuming we went for some kind of soft Brexit, you know, in the EA, are they going to have a strict legal interpretation of that article? Or actually, would they possibly have a more political, you know, relaxed approach, going, well, actually, you want this to happen, we can kind of make this happen, let's see what we can offer you, and have a little bit of horse trading there. Now, I suspect that might be possible, that more political attitude towards it, if the British team had a more constructive, positive attempt to try and create something that they were aiming for. But right now, when it's just this sort of nativist shit throwing, then obviously the Europeans are going to keep back on that very strict legal interpretation. Whether a difference, you know, in the British approach would change things is yet to be seen, because of course there is no sign of a change in the British approach.
Moving on, Peter has some economic news.
Yes,
and it's great.
Two things. First of all, the latest trade figures show Britain's trade deficit going up, getting worse in the most recent quarter. That's despite this big fall in the pound that was supposed to have boosted our exports. The second thing is a study by the Institute of Government, which goes through all the horrors that are awaiting British businesses if we leave the customs union. The thing that jumped out to the headlines was the fact that just the extra cost of filling out customs declarations could easily top £4 billion a year. Then on top of that, there's all the other stuff that it gets listed in this report that could cost businesses a lot of money. You know, when lorries are halfway up the M1 queuing to get in and out of Dover, all those orders that will be lost, all the perishable goods that will perish, all the costs of hiring the extra staff to deal with the customs inspections. We don't even know, of course. They didn't try, and we can't even put a cost on all of that stuff because we don't know what our eventual trade arrangements.
I think I can put a cost on it.
Go on.
It'll all add up to 350 million a week.
Well, indeed.
And I have more authority for saying that than bloody Boris Johnson did.
It sounds perfectly plausible, although it'll probably be 350 million a day, more like it.
Will a transition period help?
Well, it depends what you do in the transition period. We're talking about 2 or 3 years. And if you remember, the government is already setting up this whizzy new customs computer system that they started on pre-Brexit to basically make the existing trade with the non-EU countries a lot easier for businesses. That is looking like it's in trouble, like all big government IT projects. They're depending on an even whizzier version, which they conjured out of nowhere in one of their recent papers, that will make everything possible to trade with the EU smoothly and so on. So where is this computer system? It's not going to appear in 2 years or 3 years, maybe in 10, but is anybody talking about a 10-year transition?
I was having dinner with some trade negotiators the other day, and they were, I mean, literally laughing at the position papers were the butt of every joke, those who had read it. I mean, they couldn't have been more abject scorn in their approach to the stuff that was being suggested. Of course, especially all the stuff about having some kind of customs membership where we would impose one level and then we track goods to the thing. They're literally falling over themselves laughing at dinner tables
and
over these
British
ideas.
Or EU trade negotiators?
No, these guys are mostly sort of freelancers, so they've worked for the EU,
right,
who they have very little good things to say about. You know, it's not as if they enjoy doing trade deals with the EU.
Maybe they're just misanthropes. Maybe.
Well,
just,
I mean, hanging around.
I'm sure they think of themselves as gunslingers roaming the world, you know. Australia one day, you know. Canada the next.
If only they were in charge, yeah, everything would be great.
They actually had a good saying for what it was like negotiating on behalf of the EU in a trade deal, which is, imagine being in a car with 28 mothers-in-laws in the back seat, and they've all got their own brake. And so, you know, obviously that is how I guess it feels for them. But the other side of that is a democratic structure, a rule-based structure in which to do this stuff, unlike the horse trading bilateral stuff that we will see via Donald Trump. But nevertheless, you know, on the customs stuff, it was clear from very early on, the reports that came out during the referendum and immediately afterwards said billions and billions of pounds a year. And most of that isn't really tariffs. Most of that is country of origin. If you're BMW, right, and you've got to charge an extra 10% on the product, it doesn't really matter. You're selling a BMW. Most people that buy a BMW could handle another 10%. But the point where you have all of these extensive bureaucratic requirements that change the fundamental way that you operate and what you need to show, you have to show where the origin comes from for every component part of a product like a car. That is a completely different kettle of fish and something that really clogs up your economy in a way that you simply can't get rid of. We know it's absolutely disastrous. They keep on pushing towards it. I can't see any way out. And in fact, some people in Brussels think it's already too late on the customs union stuff, because you've got to leave the customs union in order to rejoin. Whichever way we do it, they'd need a bespoke customs arrangement for us to fit in. It looks absolutely horrific, and it's very hard to see how we're going to avoid it.
No wonder you enjoyed hanging out with those trade negotiators. But you're miserable.
The sheer fucking glamour of it.
Just moaning on country of origin. Finally, the last night of the proms, traditionally the most Brexity night of the year, took a surprising turn after Remainers handed out 7,000 free EU flags, almost three times as many as last year. TV personality Nigel Farage, who had promised a counterattack of Union Jacks but failed to deliver flag wars, was predictably disgusted. And if Nigel's sad, then we're happy. Now, Nick, I'm sure I saw a tweet from you a few weeks ago about something else, to the effect that the culture wars ruin everything they touch.
Yeah.
And that on sides. Is this a sort of special case because it is inherently sort of, it is become a political event and an event about nationalism?
Well, people used to say about the English culture, I'm quite specifically talking about England here, not confusing England and Britain, English nationalism was low-key, it was tolerant, it was accepting. Last night of the proms was soft and gentle, not armies marching down streets, goose-stepping or tanks parading in Red Square or North Korea. Nothing like that at all. And it was all a bit of a joke. Now that, as I said the other day, is in itself a nationalist boast. We are so self-confident, we are so relaxed, we are so cool, we don't even have to do all this stuff other countries have to do. But on the other hand, it was a nice thing about England, something worth defending. At the proms for years and years and years, they've had, you know, the singer singing Rule Britannia could be from Germany or France or Finland or wherever, as a conductor could. You could wave any flag you wanted. Now, because of Brexit, just as it's poisoning so much else, this rather gentle, half tongue-in-cheek event, very English event, really, not British, it's suddenly, well, there's a culture war around it. on both sides. You know, the people screaming about it are upset that there were so many EU flags. And it does show how culture wars poison. That something as, you know, just a bit of fun, really, the last night of the proms suddenly becomes politicised. What culture war means, in effect, is the everyday becomes politicised. You have to take a position on things you never thought you had to take a position on before. Yeah. And that is not for the good.
And we had that with Big Ben recently as well. Suddenly,
I'm afraid I just stopped bloody caring about that point. When the whole, what was it, Andrea Leadsom and Big Ben? I thought, do I go into this? You know, realistically, at my age, how many years have I got left? How many great novels and films have I not read or seen? Let's just leave this one.
I started reading these very alarming phrases, but I don't know whether people realise how alarming they sound. That Tim Montgomery, I think this morning, tweeted that BBC had an item, I think, on the Today programme that was sort of about the implications of Brexit. And Tim Montgomery said, well, it's starting to sound unpatriotic.
Yeah, but
as if journalists were meant to be patriotic.
No. Dorian, you're going to get used to that. By God, get used to that. As this mess builds up, as real wages fall, as all the promises that 17.4 million people voted for last year turn out to be a pack of bloody lies, they are going to have to come back and say, anyone pointing this out, anyone saying how, as I think the BBC were this morning, how jobs are going overseas, or was it Paris coming to London saying, come work here, you know, you can still be in the EU. You are stabbing your country in the back. You are lacking in patriotism. As I said the other day, patriotism will be the first resort of the scoundrels. It's all they've got left to turn everyone, that is the 16 million people who voted Remain, and, you know, people who voted Leave in good faith and suddenly realised they sold a pile of shit, turn them all into traitors. Say, if you do that, now this is far more than the cultural, this is incredibly dangerous. It is to say that half the country is treasonable, that's language not of cultural, that's language of civil war. Mm-hmm. And it says so much about people like Montgomery that they're prepared to use that.
Well, you made the point in a column recently that the riposte to all of this is that if we didn't care about the country, we'd just sit back and let it go to pot. It's the fact that we do care about the country that we're making a fuss and saying we shouldn't be doing all this.
Yeah.
But there's such an effort to sort of own, obviously to own Britishness for a particular political side. And in this case, Farage was trying to own music and the ghost of Beethoven. And he was going, as for this airy-fairy music crosses all borders nonsense, music is also an important part of national symbolism in every part of the world. I mean, which it is, but, like, both and. And then he goes, I'm sure if Beethoven were alive today, and as one of the world's foremost Beethoven scholars, he'd know, he would be horrified to learn that Ode to Joy was being hijacked by a band of crooks in Brussels. And you get these kind of ridiculous things. You see it on the, you know, I mean, God, you see it with, like, Orwell all the time. Well, I think Orwell would definitely agree with me, says somebody on the alt-right, you know. Yeah. And I think there is a sense of a kind of a sickening of the culture that it's not just, like you were saying, really, that so much to do with the EU. It used to be a specialist interest. It used to be, I remember it was the most boring part of my A-level politics course, you know. And it was sort of, you know, it's glad somebody was thinking about this, but you didn't have to be thinking about it all the time. And now, in parallel to how Americans, I think, feel about Trump, is that it just poisons everything. Yeah, so every single argument is framed through this.
Well, but Dorian, the way to fight back, and this is a problem for a section of the English intelligentsia, I would say, but the way to fight back is to reclaim the flag, is to reclaim patriotism, to say, what the hell is patriotic about throwing people on the dole? What the hell is patriotic about tearing up our European alliance at the very moment that dangerously unstable President of the United States is the alternative? What is unpatriotic about making the country poorer? What is patriotic? What is unpatriotic about, you know, going ahead with a decision that will lead to higher taxation and poorer public services? Yeah, that's not patriotism. Yeah, it's because, as Peter said, we don't hate our country. It's because we care about our country that we are so angry about the complete mess you're making of it.
Now, you write a column for, as well as the Observer column, you write a column for The Spectator, which, where I'd imagine on this issue, the readership and you are not always hand in hand. Do you read your comments?
No. No, I mean, it's no, seriously.
There goes my follow-up question.
No, Jeremy's read their comments. I mean, you know, I mean, the Guardian people in a way are just as bad as spectators. When young journalists come to work on The Guardian and Observer, the first week they normally end up in tears. I say, why are you crying? Have we read the comments? Say, for goodness sake, the first rule of journalism is never read the comments. You know, you just form an entirely false picture of the reader who actually overwhelmingly intelligent and nice, you know, because a few people of doubtful mental stability, I think I can put it like that, just monopolise the comments.
I have read some of them.
Have you?
Yeah, some of them are...
Poor fellow.
Some of them are quite cross. I suppose that you do feel, and I see it a lot on Twitter as well, this like tremendous rage coming from what is technically the winning side.
Yeah.
What does this sort of rage sort of tell us about, I suppose, the kind of mindset of the Brexit camp and where that might lead?
Well, I find it very revealing. For the first reasons, they ought to be happy. They've won. They've got what they wanted. Why aren't they happy? Well, the first reason is some part of them must understand that this is going to go down as one of the great lies that was sold to the British public. That what they and maybe sold to them, maybe they were fooled too. Some part of them knows it's not going to work. And second, to go back to your earlier point, is in a funny way, the Brexit vote for at least some people wasn't really about the EU. It was about a wider culture war, about the way the country's changing, about liberalism, social liberalism, sexual morals, different white faces not dominating every street, on and on it goes. And so they can never be happy. They can never be satisfied. Even when they win, they're still losing. And that's where the anger comes from too.
And like you were saying earlier, there is this danger, therefore, of a kind of if anything goes wrong, of this sort of a stab in the back myth.
Yes,
I
mean,
they can't blame themselves. So
yeah, I've been saying it from the start, because, and you know, it's easy to just pick on Nigel Farage, but you know, it wasn't just Nigel Farage. It was Boris Johnson. It was David Davis. It was Michael Gove. It was the Daily Telegraph as well as the Daily Mail. In other words, supposedly mainstream conservatives who did not think this through. That's the kindest... Let's say they lied. Okay, they didn't think it through. Because they had thought this through, they wouldn't have done it. If they had thought through the consequences of Brexit, they wouldn't have done it. So what happens when reality bites? Do all those people hold up their hands and say, oh dear, I'm really sorry, I got this totally wrong. Actually, we should probably just stay. There is a huge opening because the very complexity of Brexit will lead to massive disappointments. Because what they said will be over in, you know, they talked it would be over in a few months. You still see people interviews on the TV saying, oh, I thought we'd left already. What? Do you not read Ian Dunn? This is going to take a decade. This is going to suck all the oxygen from the room. The great problems and the many problems facing our country, 99% of them have nothing to do with Brexit. They will not be addressed. Because all the energy, the entire civil service will be trying to make this clapped-out vehicle run. And as that disappointment builds and the disillusion builds, instead of the people responsible holding up their hands and missing their head, there's a huge possibility for saying, well, the elite, well, the establishment in the back, well, the BBC ran a story that was unpatriotic. It's the BBC's fault. I think there is a market there. I think if Johnson, who clearly is being briefed against by all his colleagues, not just his opponents, if Johnson wants to confirm the worst opinion everyone else has of him, and I think he does, if he wanted to spin out of the government and launch a hard Brexit attack, the people have been betrayed, the establishment have stabbed back, that's why the land of milk and honey is not here. There's an opening for it.
Obviously, we're sort of on one mind on this issue in this room, but there is a, I think you were critical in that piece about patriotism recently, of the kind of the AC Grayling tendency, the cancel Brexit, the dangers of sort of denying democratic will.
Yeah. It wasn't so much cancel Brexit I was critical of, but the people who go around saying, oh, well, the referendum wasn't binding. Oh, well, only They lump together the non-voters, the people who voted, and say only 33% or whatever voted for Brexit. We can ignore this. That is hopeless. It is undemocratic. They certainly wouldn't say it if the vote had been the other way around. They wouldn't say, oh, well, the decision to stay in the EU wasn't binding, we can still leave. It's in intellectual bad faith. But it's also the only way this is going to change is... Same problem the Democrats have in America of overturning Trump. You've got to split your opponents in two. You've got, on the one hand, the hard right ideologues, you're never going to convert them. On the other, you've got millions and millions of perfectly decent people who voted for people or positions you don't like, and you've got to try convert them. You cannot possibly convert them if you say, oh, we don't count your votes. We don't even recognise what you did in June was valid. They'll just get the huff and go.
There's always that sort of sense of you've got to have fair play at this point. And you're right, that, you know, the stuff about saying it's advisory, it's cheating. Yeah. And the stuff that's saying, you know, well, you haven't counted the non-voters. I mean, it's not like in a general election anyone counts them either. That's also cheating.
In some senses, everyone in this room, we voted Remain, well, OK, we lost. It's the people who voted Leave who matter. The people who voted Leave you have to convert. And you're not going to convert them.
Or the people who didn't vote.
You're not going to convert them by saying, we don't even count your vote because we didn't like it. Yeah, we're not going to convert them by saying you're all racist, because leaving everything else aside, it's not true. You convert them by having a civilised argument.
Where do you come on this sort of emotion rationality thing? The thing that's often sort of held up against people like me that have been banging on about, you know, the trade or whatever, is, well, fine, but you don't want to debate that way. And, you know, the sort of Leave.eu guys loved it when people were trying to refute them. They just said, well, it's a fundamentally emotional debate that we're having about identity, as you sort of alluded to with the stuff around the culture war. It's just... it seems to me like that must be true, but then the only answer to that is to wade into a culture war, and that seems dangerous in and of itself.
Well, it's horses for courses in. But, I mean, one point about boring, complicated facts is sooner or later you have to live with them. A colleague was saying to me that Dominic Cummings of the Leave campaign knew the 350 million figure a week was a lie, but he wanted to put the lie out there because then people would stand up and start saying, but that's not true, the Office of National Statistics ordered you to take this down and all that, because then the debate was all where he wanted it to be. He didn't care that he was being exposed as a charlatan. He just wanted the emotional debate, because we still did give, in the narrow sense, more money to the EU than we got back, if you exclude all the trade and everything. So he wants it there. He wants on the emotional thing of foreigners taking the money. On the other hand, you know, that will be on Boris Johnson's gravestone. You know, it will be on Michael Gove's gravestone. It is just a brass-necked political lie. So what you've got to do is keep emphasising now, where extraordinarily, we were just getting out of the 2008 crash. You know, working people were just about seeing real wage increases. First time since 2005, actually, because it started before the crash. Mm. And then bloody Brexit comes along. The pound's sinks through the floor, inflation goes up, particularly food inflation, which hit the poorest hardest because, you know, centigrade portion of their budget on food. It might be boring, it might be factual, it might be very emotional to say, Brexit has done this to you. And actually, you can get quite emotional about it. You can get quite angry about it. So, you know, we're in a different world from the world of a referendum. We're in a world where the people who bought this have got to be held to account. And one thing that worries me about the Labour Party is that it's pathetic at holding them to account. It should be hammered home every day. David Davis got away in the Commons, or said in the Commons the other day, I never promised that Brexit would be easy. Yes,
he did. Like literally those words.
Yes, he did. And because the Labour Party is such a shambles, normally, you know, before Corbyn, you've had the Labour Party on to you saying, right, Nick, I've got 50 quotes of David Davis saying Brexit will be easy. Do you want them? We're giving them to everyone. You know, nothing like that. There's no kind of proper oppositional fight back against this. But still, it's got to be done.
Well, we're going to talk a bit more about how this affects the parties after a quick commercial break for Peter.
Yes, pot noodle. It's the ideal snack for a working newspaper column. No. Wrong script. Life isn't all about cheap flags and trade deficits. It only feels like it. There's also music, films, books and television. Our sibling podcast, Big Mouth, is the pop culture talk show that asks some of Britain's best writers to weigh up the most interesting new releases. There's a new episode every Saturday morning. This week, the team are discussing, among other things, the new new mega box set of David Bowie's Berlin period albums. You can find Big Mouth at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. It's The Great Escape.
So we were just talking about Labour there, and Ian, I think, suggested the other week that the secret to the kind of Labour position in Europe, that there were kind of two things. One was that it was largely about domestic political strategy. Two, that Corbyn is not a hardcore Eurosceptic and doesn't actually just care that much and has other kind of issues on his plate that he would rather concentrate on. How do you explain kind of Labour's position at the moment?
Dear God. Right. Corbyn and MacDonald. No one talks about MacDonald. He seems to sort of disappear. So it seems to have locked him in the cellar for the time being. And they are. They are anti you, but they're sort of anti-everything. So Ian's right in the sense of if you go back through the Morning Star and Socialist Worker, you know, these are papers that best reflect Corbyn and MacDonald's views. They're anti-EU because they're just, you know, they're Marxist-Leninists. They're anti-everything. Western, but it's not a huge cause for them.
Mm.
It's not like trade union rights or Chavez's Venezuela or Cuba or whatever. But they just are. Of course they're anti-EU. So there's that. I mean, the poor old dear doesn't seem to understand it. Corbyn keeps saying we can remain a member of the single market. You can't be a single member of the single market if you leave the EU. Yes, you can. Norway is. The real problem is this. Theresa May should not be prime minister. She is so weak. You have Liam Fox, who, by any standards in politics, is a minister waiting to be exposed. Boris Johnson again. David Davis, who I've got far more time for, but again, everything he sold the public is turning out not to be true. But you have this paradox of because of the Corbyn-McDonnell leadership, they're not being attacked. I mean, Keir Starmer's doing his best and made some important changes maybe you want to talk about. But one of the staggering things is you have Corbyn take over the Labour Party in 2015, and they say, and you think to them the worst thing in the world is a Tory. They accuse everyone of being a Tory. You know, anyone who disagrees with on the left is a red Tory, or you're doing the Tories well. When it comes to fighting actual Tories, they're hopeless at it. They don't do it at all. Not a single minister has been forced out of office by an opposition campaign or attack since 2015. Now, you go back to the 1990s when Blair and Smith were laying into John Major's government, or from 1997 to 2010 when opposition, Conservative opposition were very successful at, say, driving Labour Home Secretaries out. David Davis used to do it almost yearly. They don't know how to do it. So whatever else Boris Johnson or Liam Fox are worried about, whatever else is keeping up at night, it is not the fact that Emily Formbury is going to just destroy them in the Commons and make their position untenable. So it's almost like they go on about Blairites and things like that, but they have triangulated with the Tories on Brexit, you know, in a way Tony Blair hasn't. There isn't the energy, the anger, the vigour, the hard work being done to expose what is happening to the country.
Well, if you say, I mean, the sort of the case against the current leadership is, you know, on this issue is one, this sort of like lack of kind of parliamentary street fighting nous.
Which matters.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, particularly if you sold yourself to Labour Party members of, we will take the fight to the Tories, unlike these horrible centrist compromisers, they can't fight the Tories at all. And moreover, have ideological and cynical reasons for not wanting to do it, not wanting to fight them.
But given that you were saying that a large part of Brexit was this sort of anti-elitist moment, given Labour's unexpectedly strong performance in the election, do you think that a alternative Labour leader from that was associated with, you know, the old guard, was associated with elites, they might be better at, like you said, kind of messaging, sending things out to journalists, putting pressure on ministers, but do you think that they would be doing better with the public at this particularly sort of volatile moment?
Because it is wider than Corbyn and MacDonald. It's far wider. I think you or Ian mentioned Caroline Flint. There are a lot of Northern and Midland MPs who just are frightened. They're frightened that if they have an argument with their constituents about this, they could lose their seats. So they are not kicking up a fuss. Often people from the right of the party. So Labour is, in some sense, just scared. It did very well at the election by appearing to be an anti-Brexit party in London and Oxford and Cambridge and Brighton, and a pro-Brexit party in the Yorkshire mill towns. how it might get away with it politically. I mean, you can see that. I mean, I think it's in more difficulty because if Theresa May had a majority, all the focus would be on her. Because she has no majority, there is focus on Labour. But what it means is that Yorkshire MPs, Lancashire MPs, Welsh and Midlands MPs are not going to talk to their constituents about this. They're not going to point out how their constituents have been misled. They're not going to point out how this is going to go wrong. They're not going to be politically brave, in other words, which is why I was saying to Ian earlier in the podcast show, event, extravaganza, whatever you want to call this, that actually there's going to be quite substantial Tory rebellions to get things through. So politically, because of the triangulation Corbyn has tried to do with the Tories on so much, and because of his lack of interest, that is not just a problem with the far-left leadership of the Labour Party. It goes way, way beyond into working MPs for working-class constituencies all over Britain.
Out of interest, what do you think a sort of more centre-left leadership of the Labour Party would have done in this sort of scenario? Like if it had been Liz Kendall that had won, or if it was still Ed Miliband? Or something.
Well, I think they would still have had problems. But here's my difficulty with the way they're behaving. One way or another, this argument is going to be sorted out by the spring. If the economy is in dire straits at the spring, I think the political situation will look very different. How can Labour, perhaps with Keir Starmer, perhaps being tactically clever by allowing Keir Starmer to at least wave a quavering voice and make the odd oppositional point, you know, and Labour could benefit from that. But the fact that the Labour Party has been such a mess, and is, to be fair to it, hugely divided within itself, as divided as the Tory Party, possibly more so, again, it does leave the space I was talking to you earlier for a far right wing stag in the bat myth to gain currency, because it's not. You watch Prime Minister's questions and you see Theresa May, I mean, just a crippled Prime Minister, a Prime Minister, you know, who shouldn't be there. You see the government, a great international crisis for Britain, as big as Suez, I would say, certainly. And the leader of the opposition never asks a question on it. Now, you couldn't imagine Hugh Gaitskell in 1956 confronted with Anthony Eden's lies about Suez, saying, you know what, I'm going to ask about Social Security or council house building. You know, I mean, in politics, it might not be the agenda Corbyn wants to talk about. He wants to talk about redistribution of wealth and benefits. And good, actually, I'm glad he is. But, you know, in politics, you have to deal with what's in front of you. The idea that you can be clever and sort of avoid this or just let Keir do a bit there, I don't buy that.
Well, do you think, because, I mean, so much of it does seem to have been delegated to Keir Starmer, and he seems to get kind of a good change of policy or clarification of policy.
Yeah.
Are you impressed? Do you think he's the right man in that?
I am impressed, and I'm impressed by what you don't see as well. I'm sure he had to do an awful lot of politicking to get Labour to once again, you know, actually behave like an opposition and not the red Tories they are under Corbyn. Can you please keep that in? I just want to say this again and again and again. But that's not the same as an opposition when presented with huge open goals. I mean, you don't even have to say we reject Brexit to start pulling apart how the public, including your own constituents, were lied to. All we're getting at the moment is some waffle about a pro-jobs Brexit. I mean, a colleague of mine on The Guardian said yesterday, but Brexit's going to mean lots of jobs are lost. What is a pro-jobs Brexit? It doesn't exist. You have to be clever politically. They're in a very difficult position, the Labour Party, and that would have been the case whoever was leader. But because they're not smart, because they're not concentrated on the national crisis, then it's worse than it would have been under any other leader.
It's funny, I think almost the most effective word they could have in the way that they approach Brexit is the word shambles. Huh. It doesn't need to be Brexit's a bad idea in and of itself, just saying you've made an absolute shambles of this. The manner the Tories have done it has been completely cack-handed and inept. And that seems to me to be pretty powerful in a way of sort of dodging an awful lot of the dangers that they have.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think one of the problems Labour has, and it still has, particularly with John McDonnell, is you're just incompetent. You know, it's not ideological left, right, we don't care about this, we can't trust you to manage the country, to manage the shop. Well, exactly. Look at what the May administration is doing. I mean, again, that's not being hammered home.
This is a reminder. It seems to have been forgotten by a lot of Corbynites after the election that actually he's not very good as a leader. No. That hasn't gone away, has it?
Oh, you went there.
Also, Dorian.
Now we're in trouble.
Also, Dorian, to go back to your point, and I think this is an important argument to make. You said, but the country is against the elites. Yeah, but who is the elite now? The Brexiteers are the elite. They're in control. They have the power. Now, I know societies have multiple elites, but if the people in power want to pretend we're not the elite, I mean, there's no elite in political history that hasn't had control of political power. They are in control now. They must be answerable. I mean, Trump uses the same language in America. Hold on a second. You're president, and Republicans control the House, the Senate, and all the Supreme Court nominations.
But Saturday Night Live is the elite.
You are the elite now. So what is being missed is the ability to turn anti-elitist rhetoric on the new elite, and what is being missed is the far older parliamentary and journalistic duty of holding them to account, because they are in power. What else are you meant to do with them apart from hold them to account?
Well, finally, along with sort of pretty much every other political columnist, and I think everyone in this room, you underestimated Corbyn's pull at the ballot box this time. Do you think he'll make it to number 10 next time?
That's a good question. He could. I mean, for the very reason we were just talking about, because this government is such a mess, because it's embarked on a political project of Brexit which is doomed to fail. Well, which, I mean, doesn't mean we won't leave the European Union. We will, as things stand, but it will just be a national disaster and will be seen as such. And because it is a national disaster, it will pull apart the Tory party. More than the Labour Party, even the divisions in the Labour Party are just as great, they are in opposition.
Mm.
So there's not the same pressure on them. So that could be fun. We could have Brexit followed by John McDonnell as Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Marvellous.
Buy gold and ammunition, I say.
Onwards. Finally, I went on the People's March for Europe on Saturday along with Peter, Roz Taylor, our producer Matt, and some children, because I believe that children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. If you missed it, there's a mini podcast with interviews from the march, including Labour MEP Seb Dance. And that's on our usual podcast feed. And that's the end of the show. Thanks to Ian and Peter, as always, and to our special guest, Nick Cohen. Nick, what are you working on at the moment? Are you still deep in the Brexit trenches? Or are you?
I'm trying to write a book. But not about this. I'm trying to find a way of writing about the cynicism of populism, about elitists using the language of revolution and anti-elitism, and find a way to put that all together. I'm a long way from getting there. But, yeah.
Fantastic.
I'm on the journey, as I believe they say these days in the media.
Remember, you can hear this podcast and all of our back catalogue at audioboom.com/channel/Romaniacs-podcast, and you can find links to all the places you can hear the show at romaniacs.com. And this week's sign-off is in Italian. It comes from listener Adam Steinhardt.
Ciao a tutti, ci vediamo settimana prossima. Buttiamo Boris Johnson nel Mediterraneo.
Tweet us your translations, and we'll see you next week when our guest will be Romaniacs Hall of Famer Gina Miller.